Welcome to the LRIS Q&A podcast. This podcast features questions on public safety, labor, and employment issues submitted to us via our website, www.lris.com. Questions are answered by LRIS Director and noted labor attorney, Will Aitchison. LRIS and Will Aitchison do not provide any legal advice. Listeners to this podcast and visitors to the LRIS website should consult with their own lawyer for legal advice. LRIS is not a law firm, and our employees are not acting as your attorney. The information contained in this podcast and on LRIS.com is general legal information and should not be construed as legal advice to be applied to any specific factual situation. Will, here's our first question. Our fire department barely keeps any records of trade time. If a firefighter wants to trade shifts, at most the trade will be documented with an email from a supervisor approving of the trade. Does this violate the FLSA?
Trade time became legal under the Fair Labor Standards Act in November 1985, in the months after the Supreme Court's decision in Garcia versus San Antonio Metropolitan Transit Authority, a case in which the court held that the FLSA could be applied to cities and counties and state governments. Trade time was not really a practice that existed very much under the private sector rules of the Fair Labor Standards Act, and so Congress thought it necessary to put into place a new section of the FLSA. It's called Section 7P, or if you're counting, 29 United States Code, Section 207P. That controlled the circumstances under which trade time could occur without employer liability under the FLSA. There are a number of general rules with respect to trade time. Trade time is permitted without any employer overtime liability, assuming that the trade time is voluntary. Trade time can't be done at the insistence or the order of the employer. Instead, it is up to individual employees to enter into what the FLSA calls a substitution agreement. Now to the question at hand. What records does an employer need to keep of an exchange of work, of trade time, in order to avoid possible liability under the FLSA? The Department of Labor has actually directly addressed this in one of its regulations, and this is Section 533.31C of Title 29 of the Code of Federal Regulations. You can find this online through the Department of Labor's webpage at dol.gov. And in this regulation, the Department of Labor has written, and I'm quoting, "A public agency which employs individuals who substitute or trade time under this subsection," and that's referring to Section 7B, "is not required to keep a record of the hours of the substitute work." In other words, as the Department of Labor later explained in an opinion letter that it issued to an employer looking for guidance on trade time, the regulation and the statute itself do not impose any additional record-keeping requirements when employees are trading time for one another. Incidentally, another trade time issue that has come up recently that has actually led to some litigation that ended up in a federal court of appeals, concerns this question. Let's say you have an employee who's working Monday through Friday. Just for simplicity's sake, let's assume they're working a 5-8 schedule and they work Monday through Friday. On Friday, the employee trades time with another employee. And employee two, the person who will be working Friday, will get the trade repaid later in the year sometime. Then on Saturday, immediately after the employee traded the day away and didn't work it, employee one comes in and works on Saturday. Now, if that trade shift counts as work hours for employee one, the employee who actually didn't work the time because they traded it away, then that Saturday would be overtime work under the FLSA. It would be work greater than 40 hours in a work week. If, on the other hand, the work on Friday counts towards the work of employee two, the employee who actually worked it, then employee one wouldn't be entitled to any overtime, at least under the FLSA, for the work on Saturday. So who does it count for? Does it count for employee one or employee two? The Department of Labor says that time counts for employee one, even though the employee didn't actually work that time. And in fact, that issue was litigated all the way up to the 8th Federal Circuit Court of Appeals. That's the Federal Court of Appeals that has jurisdiction, think of it as sort of the Great Plains states, North Dakota, South Dakota, Minnesota, Iowa, Missouri, Arkansas, and New England. And in that case, decided by the 8th Circuit, it's a case called Senger, S-E-N-G-E-R, versus City of Aberdeen, South Dakota, the court held that the Department of Labor's regulation was valid. In other words, employee one would get credit for having worked that Friday, even though they didn't actually perform the work in question. And the Department of Labor's position on this is actually pretty logical, if you think about it. There's only three choices, right? And choice one is employee one gets credit for the time even though they didn't work it. Choice two is employee two, who worked it, gets credit for the time. And choice three, which is the position the employer took in that City of Aberdeen case, was nobody gets any credit for the time. What the Court of Appeals said, what the Department of Labor said was, well, we know somebody's got to get credit for the time because work was performed. The court also said Section 7P and the regulations are very clear that the employee who is working the shift, in other words, who has traded with employee one, our employee two in our example, doesn't get credit for the time. By default, the court and the Department of Labor say employee one must get credit for having worked the time.
Question number two. Our department has instituted a policy requiring employees to provide a doctor's note whenever they use sick leave. Is this policy legal?
As with many labor law issues, you have to analyze a question like this, looking at different laws and regulations, different sources of the law, which can provide different rights for employees and different obligations for employers. The first place I'd turn with respect to any issue of sick leave is the collective bargaining agreement. What restrictions are there in the collective bargaining agreement on an employee's use of sick leave? Are there doctor's note requirements? And if so, what are those requirements? It may well be that the collective bargaining agreement forbids an employer from requiring doctor's notes or from requiring doctor's notes of all employees or before some threshold is met. But let's assume the collective bargaining agreement is silent. Let's also assume there's no state law that controls the use of sick leave, which there might be. Some states, California, for example, do have laws like that. But let's assume there's nothing but federal law that concerns this issue of doctor's notes. What is the state of federal law on this issue? And I think we're in a position now where we can say that the law is becoming awfully clear with respect to an employer's ability to require employees to produce doctor's notes. And the law that the courts are centering on is the Americans with Disabilities Act. It's not widely known, but the ADA actually has some privacy provisions in it. There is a section of the ADA that states that an employer may not, and this is almost a direct quote, make any inquiries about the nature or extent of an employee's disability unless the employer can meet two tests. The employer has to show that the inquiry is job-related, and it has to show that the inquiry is consistent with business necessity. If you think about it, a request for a doctor's note is in fact a request for information that would show something about the nature or extent of a disability. And therefore, the ADA's privacy provision comes into play. The employer is going to have to show that its request or its policy of requiring doctor's notes is job-related and consistent with business necessity. We've now seen a series of cases, by my count, at least six of these cases, that have held that a general doctor's note requirement fails the privacy tests of the ADA. Courts have said, and two of the earliest cases come out of New York, one involving the transit system in New York City and another involving the statewide Department of Corrections, courts have said that there are actually fairly limited circumstances under which an employer can provide or require a doctor's note. One of the circumstances is if the employer can show that the employee has been abusing sick leave. Another of the circumstances is if the employer can show that there is something very highly safety sensitive about the position where the employee's condition might impair their ability to perform their job duties. In that New York Corrections case, the court held that simply the fact that we were dealing with law enforcement employees did not rise to that level of highly safety-sensitive position that justified a doctor's note requirement. Why are courts finding this way? What are courts holding that is inherent in a sick leave note requirement that potentially violates the ADA? Well, I think a very succinct wording of it comes from the most recent of these cases. It's only a few months old, a 2012 case. It's called EEOC versus Dillard's, which is the Dillard's department store. And this is a decision from a federal court in Southern California. And what this court ends up holding, and holding that Dillard's doctor's note requirement is illegal, the court ends up saying this about it. Dillard's policy required the employee to submit a doctor's note disclosing the underlying condition for which she was treated. This policy invites intrusive questioning into the employee's medical condition and tends to elicit information regarding an actual or perceived disability. And that's really the heart of it, is that the court is concerned that these sort of inquiries disclose medical information, and thus the ADA applies, and thus the ADA prohibits a blanket doctor's note requirement. Now, that said, there's something inherent in what the court said in Dillard that I think is very important that does give the employer some latitude. An employer can have a doctor's note requirement so long as the doctor's note doesn't contain actual medical information. Could such a doctor's note be of use to an employer? Well, sure. The doctor's note could say, I verify that employee Jane Doe visited me and that she had a condition that justified the use of sick leave. That would be a doctor's note that an employer, I think, might find valuable, and yet would not involve the eliciting of particularized medical information that would trigger the ADA's requirements. Now, one last note on doctor's notes, simply because I am finding employers seem to be increasingly careless about this. Let's say an employer does have a doctor's note, or does have some information about the employee's use of sick leave. Let's say, for example, the employer maintains a sick leave log where a supervisor, a captain or a sergeant or whoever it might be, records why employees are using sick leave. What does the ADA say about that information? Well, first of all, the privacy provisions of the ADA do apply to that information, and that means that the employer has to keep that information in a separate, limited access file. The only people who can see that information are people usually in the chain of command who have a need to see that information. Of course, the employer's HR personnel would likely be able to see it as well, but it should be in a separate file. It should be limited access, and there should be an access log on the file showing who has accessed the file and when. What sends shivers up my spine is when you hear of employers, and I've heard of them as recently as last week, who will keep sick leave logs, for example, in a police department on the sergeant's desk, where anybody coming by can see that Jane Doe was sick because she had a diabetes reaction. That is the breach of medical privacy that would violate the ADA.
Thank you for listening to the LRIS Q&A podcast. We hope you found it entertaining and informative. Remember, the contents of this podcast should not be construed as legal advice. Please consult your own attorney for legal advice on any specific situation.